I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. A relatively obscure drug, primarily used to deworm animals, is suddenly on the tips of all our tongues. Despite the lack of evidence that ivermectin is effective in treating COVID-19, influential people in the US and Australia have been pushing it, including Joe Rogan, whose podcast has 11 million listeners.
So we immediately threw the kitchen sink at it. All kinds of meds, monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin, Z-Pak.
This week in Australia, we found out that imports of the drug have increased tenfold. And a COVID-positive man presented to Sydney's Westmead Hospital, suffering not from the effects of COVID, but an overdose of that drug and a combination of other so-called cures he'd found online.
Present to hospital after having what seems to be an overdose or too much ivermectin as a result of you know, a misunderstanding. They think that they can take this drug to treat COVID. They were COVID positive. Can you just talk to us about the risks of using it?
Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tisher about how we report on misinformation and the anti-vax movement in Australia. It's Friday, the 3rd of September. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Lenore, ivermectin has really hit the headlines this week in a big way. We've published a number of stories on it. What is it and where did it come from?
Yeah, well, ivermectin is an anti-parasite drug. It's mostly used to deworm animals. It does have some limited use for humans against parasites, but it has gained currency in sort of anti-vaxxer and vaccine hesitant circles online as an alleged wonder drug to cure COVID, which obviously it doesn't. And, you know, obviously COVID is a virus, not a parasite. However, it's so popular in the United States that the Food and Drug Administration had to tweet, "You are not a horse, you are not a cow, serious you all, stop it." And now it seems to be taking off here as well. So we ran stories this week about the imports of ivermectin being up tenfold because people often try and get it online, and also that people are turning up to pharmacies with prescriptions for ivermectin and they can't tell the pharmacist what it is that they actually want ivermectin for. And then we've found that there's a case that's turned up at Westmead Hospital in New South Wales, someone very sick who was COVID positive from taking ivermectin among a cocktail of other drugs that they'd ordered online because they thought that it would cure their COVID, and actually it had a really toxic effect on them. And, you know, the toxicologist at Westmead Hospital is now forced to tell people, don't look for magic cures online, don't listen to what's being peddled on the internet, because none of them work.
So what do we know about studies of this drug so far? Is it completely useless or could there be some merit to it?
So it seems like the reason that this drug, rather than any other, has been latched onto by people keen to find an unofficial cure for COVID is that there was a study last year by a team at Monash University in Melbourne, which found that ivermectin did have an effect on the coronavirus in the test tube. That is very far from showing that it has an effect or is an effective remedy in people. And the researchers themselves have been at pains to point out that that is not what their research has showed. But that initial study is probably what kicked off, well, certainly was one big reason that kicked off the craze for ivermectin among people who are mistrustful of vaccines or generally don't trust the health information coming from doctors or other respected health authorities.
And there was that other big study of ivermectin that lots of other studies were based on. And back in July, our medical editor, Melissa Davey, wrote about how that really big study that was sort of right at the heart of the arguments that ivermectin might one day be useful, that it was withdrawn because of serious ethical concerns that emerged from it. So, you know, even the studies that you know, start to show some possibility that it might be useful, are either a long, long, long way from being clear and or have been discredited.
But some of the people who are now pushing ivermectin were the same people, at least in the United States, who were pushing hydroxychloroquine last year. But they seem to have dropped hydroxychloroquine in favour of ivermectin. Is there any research or do we have any knowledge of why these groups tend to latch on to some drugs and not others?
I don't know why they latch on to one drug and not others, but I think what they're really looking for is a way to justify their reluctance to take vaccines. So I guess if you are, for whatever reason, reluctant to take a vaccine, it's difficult for you to say to other people, look, COVID is not dangerous, because clearly, you know, 4.5 million people have died. But if you can say, look, there's a cheap, easy cure, and the big big pharma, big government, whoever they are, the mainstream media, aren't telling you about it, and you need to do your own research online, and then you'll see that this easy, cheap cure exists, and we needn't have lockdown, and you needn't lose your freedoms, and you don't have to take a vaccine. It's a sort of side door into the anti-vaxxer argument, I think.
You need to separate it from, to some extent, from sort of rational discussion about whether it's an effective remedy or not. I mean, so far, the research is continuing. It's not been abandoned. It hasn't been discounted as something that is definitely not effective, because that's not how science works. You just say, so far, there is no evidence that it's effective. That's not really what we're talking about. It just becomes this kind of, once these things get a certain head of steam behind them, it just becomes this kind of totem that if you believe in certain things, then that's one of the various things that you can pick from, whether it's being against mask mandates in the US, particularly more than here, whether you're against lockdowns, whether you're against vaccinations, whether you're in favour of ivermectin. It just becomes one of that sort of grab bag of things that if you're troubled by the official response to the pandemic and you're searching for a different response, then there it is. And once it gets to a certain critical mass, then it's unstoppable regardless of any arguments about whether it actually is or is not effective.
So how much do we know about how widespread this theory has become in Australia, and who's promoting it here?
Part of the difficulty is that we don't really know how widespread it is. There are some MPs like Craig Kelly who have been promoting ivermectin pretty heavily, and he's now in league with Clive Palmer after finally leaving the Liberal Party. There's various groups of, you know, various groups of influencers and anti-vaxxers who push these ideas online. And I guess because it isn't happening in the broad light of day, because it's happening on Telegram and through this disparate group set of people coming from disparate places, it is actually quite hard to assess how much of a foothold it's got. The Melbourne Institute does do a vaccine hesitancy tracker, which shows that hesitancy across the country is falling just slightly to just over 20%, but the fall is in the number of people who are unsure. The number who are saying they're unwilling to get a vaccine is sort of unchanged. So I think we're kind of in this, at this point, where there's an unsure grouping who, you know, are being pulled one way or the other, the official health advice and then all this stuff that they're seeing online, which is actually very difficult to counter.
I think those figures are quite encouraging in part. That group of flat anti-vaxxers seems relatively stable at about 10%. And the group that is unsure, which you maybe is sort of varying between states, is sort of something like 15 to 20% more, seems to be coming down most strongly in the past few months in the states where there have been COVID outbreaks, particularly New South Wales and Victoria. So it seems like the main driver against vaccine hesitancy is actually when COVID is more prevalent in the community and people are therefore encouraged, in some cases mandated, depending on who they work for, to get the vaccine. And that seems to be dispelling vaccine hesitancy. I guess once you've had the vaccine, then you're no longer going to reply that you're hesitant about getting it.
Or when you know lots of people who have and nothing bad's happened to them.
I mean, you wouldn't want to read, you know, you wouldn't want to be too confident about saying that the misinformation is not having a strong effect, because we should be cautious about overstating its effect, yeah, because the evidence so far, and also and the polling also on what people think about the vaccine, whether they are in favour of getting the vaccine in the first place, whether they support compulsory vaccination for certain things to get into, you know, to get into venues or to travel. There's a pretty strong sort of at least two-thirds in favour in most of those categories. So I think, and that doesn't seem to be changing that much. If anything, it's strengthening, I think, as the case numbers of COVID go up.
I think Mike's absolutely right, and I hate to be the slightly gloomy one here, but I would point out that we don't have a lot of room to move, though. So if the public health advice is that we need at least 80% over 16-year-old vaccination rates in order to get, you know, some semblance of our former lives back, and hopefully more than that, then there's not a lot of room forever. So while Mike's right and, you know, the numbers are sort of heading in the right direction, we haven't got a lot of wiggle room, and that has implications for all of us and also, you know, obviously for the health outcomes of those people who aren't getting vaccinated, because, you know, around the world we're seeing the pandemic of the unvaccinated as societies open up, and the people who've refused to get a vaccine, you know, bear the consequences.
And we have seen some evidence that some of this misinformation is deliberately targeting the most vulnerable groups, which is something that I guess we have to be really wary of, where it could be disastrous. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, so far this is quite anecdotal, as you'd expect, but we have certainly been hearing quite strong indications that people are promoting ivermectin in rural Indigenous communities particularly. And obviously that's of you know, extreme concern, because in communities like that, obviously, yeah, it can be incredibly damaging, and it can reach a far higher percentage of the population without too much trouble if it once it takes hold.
And do the tech companies have a bigger role to play in this? They say they have COVID misinformation policies, but a recent NBC article that did a deep dive into ivermectin found dozens of Facebook groups really pushing these kinds of theories.
Yeah, so it seems really hard for them to clamp down on it regardless of their best intentions. You know, can debate how good their intentions are or not, but whatever they're doing, it doesn't seem to be effective. And each time this sort of stuff gets moved from one platform, it just finds a space in another one. And Telegram seems to be the, you know, the current platform for people who want to talk about ivermectin and other so-called cures. But that doesn't mean there isn't still, you know, there's not still finding it on Facebook and YouTube and other places too, on Reddit.
And I think people with these views sort of know how to speak in code sometimes to get around Facebook or social media vetting. So they will talk about their freedoms, about experimental medicine, about unproven vaccines. They know how to just sort of skate along the line of what is going to be get through the social media policies.
What's the big harm in this? You know, ivermectin is not bleach, another drug that was found to kill COVID in the lab. But is there a wider social harm that is being done by the spread of this kind of misinformation?
Again, it's hard to know the scale of it, but I think there definitely is a danger of harm, more widespread harm than just people taking something that's perhaps not going to do them too much damage unless they take it in very large doses, but is not also not going to cure them of COVID. In that, it's just in the whole mistrust of institutions, which includes government, includes health authorities, and that while you should have a skeptical attitude to all those things, you shouldn't think that they are entirely lying to you all the time either. You know, it speaks to a sort of unbalanced way of looking at the world, which is not healthy for our democracy, I don't think.
It's also got a specific harm for the individual if they're persuaded that if they've got like horse paste or, you know, parasite pills, they don't need to get a vaccine because it's a miracle cure. You know, it has very real and immediate potential impacts for them and their loved ones.
So, Lenore, given that we've got fairly low rates, although, as you say, not much room to move, of vaccine hesitancy and denial here. How do you weigh up when to tell these stories? When does The Guardian weigh in on these kinds of misinformation theories?
Look, These are really hard judgments. I find these really difficult judgments because we don't want to become, you know, a vehicle giving undue airtime to these theories and sort of effectively doing their promotional work for them. Even if the stories is just, you know, talking about what's happening, it's still giving people an insight into the fact that these sorts of views exist. So, for example, there was a much vaunted truckies blockade this week. Mm. And it seemed like it was everywhere on social media, and Pauline Hanson was talking big about paying the fines of the blockading truckies and everything. In the end, it was a complete fizzer. It was a damp squib. So not reporting much on that was in fact the right call, because it would have been giving it absolutely undue prominence. On the other hand, if we have information that these views are getting currency or being pushed in really vulnerable communities where, you know, it could have an enormously detrimental effect, as Mike was just mentioning, then I think we really have a public interest duty in reporting that. So, you know, it's hard. And it's also hard to know how best to counter anti-vax information in that world of anti-vaxxers. The media is one of the people who are in whatever the big conspiracy is to sort of, you know, promote vaccination as the solution, along with, you know, all the health authorities and, you know, everybody who can read science. But if that's your view, then really strident sort of articles in the media that really deride or attack anti-vaxxers probably only serve to reinforce their views. And I think that kind of goes for the public health messaging as well. If what we're trying to do is persuade the sort of hesitant ones, then I think you need to take a pretty measured, like a factual but measured approach rather than a big stick approach. I think I understand the New South Wales Health Minister, Brad Hazzard, is, you know, super frustrated at this anti-vax message. But, you know, he's been at press conferences saying that, you know, it's what's going on in social media is like the days of the bubonic plague in the dark ages. I mean, saying things like that will actually, I think, provide ammunition to the anti-vax message. So it's hard. It's a really difficult balance to strike, but I think we have to be careful.
And there's often kernels of truth. I was reading under one of our social media posts on ivermectin, some comments that seemed entirely reasonable. This is an effective anti-parasite drug, and the person who discovered it won a Nobel Prize for it.
All true.
Yeah. And so is there anything that we've done, or how does the media act in a way that can address the genuine concerns that people may have about COVID vaccines and their safety and these other so-called miracle cures?
Yeah. Obviously, we have to provide information. We have to provide factual information about what these drugs are and what the virus is and what the variants are and all the, you know, all the scientific information we can in an accessible way as much as possible. That obviously is not enough to stop people latching on to other answers if that's what they're looking for. But we just have to try to be proportionate. And as Lenore was saying, that's difficult when it's hard to get a handle on how widespread or how pernicious these movements for ivermectin or anti-vax sentiment more generally, how many people they're reaching and what effect they're having. But obviously we've hopefully learned not to just kind of latch on to colourful characters and sensationalise them because people want to read about their, you know, in some cases, extreme views, because that serves only to promote them. But then we have to report on people who are in public life and having an influence as well. So
yeah, it's tricky.
It's just a day-by-day proposition, isn't it?
But I think there's lessons to be learned. I think there was an edition of Full Story recently that looked at how you have conversations with people you know, people in your own circle who have vaccine hesitant views or anti-vaxxer views. And the advice from the, you know, experts was to try and find some sort of common ground with them and then, you know, introduce factual information into the conversation, but to not sort of start from a hectoring type attitude. And I think that goes for the public debate as well. If you hector someone and start from the viewpoint that, you know, they must be stupid to think what they think, then they're not really going to listen to you. And, you know, certainly I have people I know who in a very surprising development to my mind, have started to have these kinds of views. And it is really hard to find some sort of common ground to have a conversation with them. But I think given the public policy consequences of vaccine hesitancy increasing rather than decreasing, we have to find a way to have those conversations.
Next, the mountain giveth and Triple J taketh away. Okay, now we come to what we can't get out of our head. Lenore, what story stuck in your mind this week?
I really love the story we wrote about a mountaineer in New Zealand who found this very old backpack with a broken camera in it on a glacier in New Zealand. And he had the film developed and saw that there were photos in there that he posted on Facebook and tried to find the owner of. And eventually it came to the attention of a doctor in Lithgow who had been climbing on that glacier 24 years ago with a friend. The friend's name was Steve Robinson. They were caught in an avalanche and sadly Steve Robinson died. And those photos of this cool-looking young guy with sunnies and long hair were actually the last taken of him before he was killed by the avalanche, which obviously brought back, you know, really sad memories for the doctor, Richard Stiles, and also for Steve Robinson's family. It sounds like he was a really good man, Steve Robinson. And as his sister said in our piece, he'd be very concerned at the reduction in ice and snow on the New Zealand glaciers, which is the reason that his backpack was eventually discovered. Anyway, it's just a lovely human story.
Amazing story. Mike, what was it for you? What could you not get out of your head?
So my favourite story this week was the one about Triple J's tweet. So the ABC's youth station got in trouble when they tweeted, they sent out a tweet saying, "Did it hurt when you aged out of the youth radio station?"
It hurt me when I did.
And so there was a lot of response to this tweet, mostly criticising them, partly for the fact that a lot of their audience, even though their remit is to talk to 18 to 24s, a lot of their audience is actually in the 25 to 39 bracket, and quite a lot of it is in the 40 to 54 bracket, and some even older. So there was a lot of criticism on various grounds about this tweet. But it sort of made me think about people my generation. I'm really showing my age here, but I feel like genuine baby boomers up to who were born sort of in the late 50s and early 60s, are the, which is not me.
he adds quickly.
Well, depends what you mean by early. My reaction to this tweet was, you should just let that go. Let the young people have their music. You
absolutely.
Keep
yeah.
your music. And
that's
don't,
what
don't
Spotify's
get upset
for.
By Triple J.
Me too.
Ignore Triple J altogether unless you like the music that they play. And yeah, just let it go. Be your own middle-aged self and stop trying to be young.
And embrace Double J.
Or yeah, Coles Radio.
Double J or earlier.
I really just realised that I like songs I can sing along to. That was my moment when I was like,
that is
Triple
really
J's
not
for
Triple
me
J.
I know, exactly. All right, thank you so much for joining us today, Lenore.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks a lot.
This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannon. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. I hope you have a great weekend. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday, and we'll see you then.